this week. Gold finished its fourth consecutive winning week above $12.50 an ounce. Well, welcome to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Great to be back with you this weekend. I'm your host, Chris Waltzek. When economist John Williams speaks, people take note. He sees big cracks in the greenback, which could cause massive inflation this year. The head of ShadowStats outlines his manifesto. Here's a spoiler alert, buy gold and silver. Next, Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors says his technical work has convinced him that the bottom is in place and that we've seen the lows in the precious metals markets, so it's time to back up the truck. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear report. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with a market weather report. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals exchanges this week. Gold finished the fourth consecutive winning week, despite dollar strength, on news of stronger-than-expected inflation numbers. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, the yellow metal added about $6, finishing near $12.54 an ounce. Silver added 15 cents, ending at $20.32 an ounce. Platinum once again outperformed, up 20, about 1.3%, finishing the week near $14.54. And palladium gained 5, closing near $750 an ounce. The weekly chart on palladium is a sight to behold. Price continues to consolidate in a bullish head and shoulders pattern and looks poised to run well above $800 an ounce. And then West Texas Intermediate crude finished the week up over a percent, $94 a barrel. Well, top market analyst Dennis Gartman says that sentiment is strongly bearish in the gold market, suggesting from a contrarian perspective, good things ahead in the year 2014 for gold investors. Investment bank HSBC also ratcheted up its target price to $12.92 an ounce. The general consensus, though, on the street is that gold will decline to $1,000 before finding a bottom. The editor of True Contrarian said many investors have positioned themselves to benefit from lower prices. He's calling for a powerful rally in 2014 with new all-time highs either in late this year or early next year. Citigroup also raised its 12-month stance on the mining firms from neutral to bullish. In global precious metals news, China's central bank is reportedly heavily accumulating gold, with speculation that stockpiles have reached 2,700 tons. Major sources of bullion in China are mine production and recycling of gold. The People's Bank of China purchased 654 tons in 2009 through 2011, about 388 tons in 2012, and 622 tons last year. The official tally has not been released, though, in over 4 years. But if one top analyst estimate is right, China is now the fourth largest global gold reserve, home to the fourth largest gold reserve. The nation holds $1.3 trillion worth of U.S. Treasury bonds, according to Bloomberg, giving it plenty of room to diversify tens of billions of dollars into gold, since it only holds 2.5% of its total reserves in the yellow metal. Compare that to 70% of gold holdings in the U.S. and Germany. The new National Gold Exchange in Shanghai continues to operate as investors expect, delivering tons of gold, 2,100 last year compared with 1,100 tons in 2012. Investment in jewelry demand could also be positively impacted in anticipation of the Chinese New Year, which begins on January 31st. Turning to the domestic news front, the consumer price index climbed the most since June of last year. That's about 0.3%, according to a Labor Department report. Prices increased at the slowest clip last year. The consumer price index only rose 1.5%. Higher inflation tends to ignite interest in the precious metals market. With the U.S. inflation rate below the Federal Reserve's 2% target, that leaves room for further QE this year, a positive for the precious metals. Bottom line on gold and silver. Well, the technical picture is still positive for gold next week, while the gold stocks appear to be entering a short covering rally. Be sure to stay tuned for my discussion with John Williams and Bob Hoy. We cover the markets, and you'll want to log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account for next week's picks and all the forecasts. We had two gold stock picks this week that performed quite well in the Alpha Stocks newsletter. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange. The Dow Jones Industrials rebounded sharply to finish in the black, up 21 points, ending at 16,458 by Friday's close. The S&P 500 gave back 3.6 points, finishing at 1838, while the NASDAQ gained 23 points, over a half a percent, finishing at 4197. The financial sector remains red hot, with Visa adding nearly 5%, Morgan Stanley up about 4% after posting better than expected quarterly profits, and Goldman Sachs even gained over half a percent on Friday. The Chicago Board of Options Exchange, the CBOE Volatility Index, jumped sharply, and this is viewed as a fear index by many investors. It's based on options traders' expectations of future price swings. When the VIX moves up, the market moves down, and vice versa. According to a Market Watch report on Friday, the U.S. stock market is more overvalued than at most previous market peaks. Of the 35 market tops since 1900, the Dow Jones Industrials has lost an average of about 31% in those bear markets that followed. Now, the metrics used to compute the figures include the price-to-earnings ratio. Currently, the S&P 500 price-to-earnings ratio is at 18.6. That's higher than those that prevailed before the other market peaks. Next, we look at the adjusted P.E. ratio. That's from Professor Robert Shiller, and it essentially adjusted for inflation. It's also looking a bit frothy. The dividend yield is around 2%, and that's a bit lower than comparable yields that prevailed at the other tops. Then there's the price-to-sales ratio, currently 1.6, which is higher than the readings for most tops. The price-to-book ratio, which you might think of as the intrinsic value for the S&P 500, is currently about 2.7, which is higher than all but five of the 28 market peaks since the 1920s. And lastly, the Tobin Q ratio, named after the Nobel laureate Professor Tobin, is higher than what prevailed in 31 of the past 35 market tops. You bring all six indicators together, well, there are signs of frothiness. Bottom line on Wall Street. My favorite sentiment indicator is actually approaching greedy levels, but it really isn't high enough to justify calling a market peak. So for next week's forecast, all the stock picks, be sure to log in to your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Coming up after the break, moreGoldSeek.com radio with John Williams and Bob Hoy. We want you to stay with us here at Gold Seek. Well, Mr. John Williams is head of Shadow Stats, an alternative economic resource online for every investor. Welcome back, John Williams.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
I thought that maybe we could begin with an interesting headline number that was released by the Labor Department last week. We hear that the national unemployment rate has plunged yet again to 6.7%. Certainly makes the general outlook somewhat more sanguine. However, some folks are concerned that the labor force participation rate remains very low, actually one of the lowest levels in decades, indicating that perhaps the situation is not as robust as our officials would have us believe.
As is often the case with the economic statistics, there are two sides to a lot of the popular numbers, and the headline unemployment rate, which is narrowly defined, is one of those. Normally, you hear the unemployment rate drops, that's good news. In normal recessions and such, that would more often than not reflect people who had been without work on the unemployment rolls gaining jobs, going back to work with the employment increasing. And when the unemployment rate drops under that circumstance, that's good news. It means things are improving. In the last year, more than the last year, last couple of years, we've seen a circumstance where the unemployment rate has been coming down. Again, that's a headline number, but it's not good news. The reason it's not good news is that we're in the most severe, most protracted economic downturn since the Great Depression. We're still in it. The economy has not recovered. As a result, what you're seeing here is that instead of the people who are dropping out of being counted as unemployed, instead of them getting jobs and being pulled into better financial circumstances by a growing economy, they're giving up looking for work, as the government defines it. And so they're being dropped from the unemployment rolls. And as they're dropped from the unemployment rolls, they're also dropped from the labor force. The labor force is a much bigger number than the number of people are unemployed. And the unemployment rate is worked as a ratio of the number of people employed, the number of people who are in the labor force. So if you have an equivalent decline in the unemployment rate and an equivalent decline in the labor force, the way it works is you get a you get an overall decline in the unemployment rate, which in this case, again, is bad news. Where it is measured and where it is reflected and where you can see whether or not this really is good news is in broader measures of the unemployment. The government publishes six levels of unemployment. Their headline number, the U3 number, is the one that gets all the press. That's the one that dropped from 7% down to 6.7%. Their broadest measure is called U6. It includes all the people in the headline number, plus people who are working part-time for economic reasons. They'd like a full-time job, but they can't get a full-time job, so they're really not fully employed. And it includes what the government counts as discouraged workers, people marginally attached to the labor force. Now, the way they define a discouraged worker these days, and you have to look at the headline definition, in order to be counted as in the headline unemployed, you have to have actively looked for work in the last 4 weeks. If you've been unemployed for a while, there are no jobs to be had, you give up looking for work, but you still consider yourself to be unemployed. You're ready and able to work. If a job were available, you'd take it. I think most people would consider such a person to be unemployed. The government counts them as a discouraged worker, but if such a person is discouraged for more than a year, then they just completely drop off the government's rolls. The way it used to be back in 1994, before they redefined the unemployment series, there was no time limit on being discouraged. You could have been discouraged for 2 years, and you'd still be counted as in the broader unemployment measures. So what you'll see is that with the U6 number, which includes the short-term discouraged workers, where the headline number dropped from 7 to 6.7%, the broadest measure put out by the government held at 13.1%. That didn't change. But in the process, there's another accounting here, which I do, because I look at the way the numbers were before the government changed the methodology. And where they used to count those who'd been discouraged for more than a year, I estimate that. I add them back in. And what you'll see is that if you add them back in, you have an unemployment rate that's up over 23%. And I'll contend that if you went around the country and asked everyone whether or not he or she were employed or unemployed, the average person has a pretty strong opinion on that, you'd come up with an unemployment rate closer to that. So that when you look at the dynamics of the unemployment, the people who consider themselves unemployed, the people who want a job but can't find one, that's increasing. It's not decreasing. It's the only reason we're seeing a drop in the headline unemployment rate is because of a narrow definition that the government uses in preparing it.
Some economists would say, well, yes, unemployment may be a bit stuck here or stubborn, but in general, it's not a leading indicator. At best, it's coincidental.
The employment is a coincident indicator, always has been. People who call it lagging like to do so because it enables them to claim that the economy is recovering while the employment is not. The authority that defines whether or not the economy is in recession is the National Bureau of Economic Research. The employment and the employment and the unemployment are coincident indicators. I mean, they're directly related to each other, just two different surveys. They timed the beginning of a recession based on the performance of the employment numbers, industrial production. Those are the two biggest indicators they use. So it's a coincident indicator. The employment has not recovered. Unemployment has not recovered, and the economy has not recovered. It's an absolute fraud. It's a reporting fantasy. If you look at the gross domestic product, which is the broadest measure published by the federal government, you'll see, and this is a measure that's adjusted for inflation, so that the movements you see are supposedly the movements in real economic activity. You're not seeing a boost in activity from inflation or deflation, whatever is involved. If you look at the official gross domestic product number, what happens is the economy started to turn down the end of 2007, crashed through 2008 into the middle of 2009, and then it started to recover. And by the second quarter of 2011, it had exceeded the levels of activity that were in place before the recession. Now you're 5-6% above that. We have an expanding economy. Happy news. Everyone should be happy and feeling good. Few people are happy and feeling good. The average guy has not seen this recovery. Most businesses I know haven't seen this recovery. Most economic statistics have not seen this recovery. There's no other major economic series that is showing that full pattern of recovery and expansion. We have some that are right at the recovery brink, but they haven't really expanded. And the reason here is fairly simple, although it takes a little bit of explaining, and it has to do with the government using too low a rate of inflation in calculating the gross domestic product. They calculate, in theory, this is how they do it, although I'll contend they actually reverse things here and back things out to where they should be. But the gross domestic product is estimated before inflation adjustment. Same way you would total up your sales or your income or what you pay at the grocery store. That's actual out of pocket money in today's dollars. Again, they adjust it for inflation to remove the effects of pricing. And if you divide it by the inflation rate and you use too low an inflation rate, you effectively overstate the inflation-adjusted economic growth. That's what's happened here. The government, over the last several decades, has changed the approach to calculating inflation with the effect of lowering the reported inflation rate, and the too low inflation that's being used to deflate the GDP accounts for the recovery. If you take, if you adjust for the misreporting of inflation, what you'll see is that the GDP, instead of plunging and then rebounding, has plunged and basically has been stagnant. It's been bottom bouncing, and now it's beginning to turn down again. That pattern of plunge and bottom bouncing, we've seen in a number of series, such as housing, such as consumer confidence, such as consumer income. Those are the indicators I've mentioned generally are ones that are free of inflation calculations. They're measured net of inflation, so that when you take the inflation out of the equation, what you see is the economy hasn't recovered.
Right now, 47 million Americans are on food stamps, and that number, of course, is continuing to grow. But another alarming statistic that's only just started to take effect, that is the 1.3 million unemployed Americans whose benefits were just cut off about a week and a half ago. That number is supposed to increase to roughly 5 million folks who will lose their extended unemployment benefits by the end of 2014. I'd like to know if you believe that this could have a significant impact on this nascent recovery.
I'll give you the benefit of the doubt in calling it a nascent recovery, because it's far from birth, but it could be there. You need to look at the consumer's liquidity for that to happen, and the loss of unemployment benefits here makes the consumer's liquidity worse, not better. If you look at median household income, that's the middle level of what an average household is getting each year, and their estimates of what this is each month, and adjust that for inflation. And here it's using the government's inflation, which I would contend is understated, and so the numbers here are overstated. It's showing that the average household today is has less income after inflation than it had back in the late 1960s, early 1970s. And where the economy started plunging into 2009 and then rebounded, as the economy plunged, the income began to plunge, but it never recovered. It continued plunging for another year or two, and then it's still stagnating. It isn't picking up. What happens here will tighten the liquidity. It's not going to be good for the economy. There are areas where the government spends money that helps to fuel economic activity. That's one area that does, and some people believe the government's numbers, mostly the politicians, and a lot of people on Wall Street selling various things. But this is an election year. Pocketbook issues are big. They will dominate an election if people are feeling enough economic pain. And I think that's the case here, that you're going to have enough people who are in enough financial distress that come the election, they're going to tend to vote against the incumbents, or at least those they blame for not taking action to help move things along. In the real world, if the things that the government could do to actually significantly turn the economy, no one's even talking about them. I would bet that before the election, you'll see efforts to put the unemployment benefits back in people's pockets. Again, recognition that the economy really isn't recovering. It's a short-term. It's effectively putting a Band-Aid on the circumstance, but the wound continues to fester. They're not doing anything to resolve things. The problems here, the reason you've had declining incomes over time, and you can look at inflation-adjusted earnings on an individual basis. They're lower today than they, again, were in 1970. They haven't shown any recovery. If you go back to the way life was in 1970, much more common that a household would have one person staying at home with the children, the other going off to earn money. And usually that would be the husband, and the wife would stay home with the kids. As the family incomes declined, couldn't keep up with inflation, usually a second person had to start working in the family, and now it's a much more common, probably the common experience today. The issues with income here and declining income and the declining purchasing power of the household go back decades, and they're tied to trade deals. Or the trade policies of various administrations. The policies that have been taken generally have encouraged a tremendous growth in our trade deficit, with the higher paying production jobs, for example, largely being lost to foreign competition offshore. So the higher paying jobs have been lost, incomes generally have declined. That's an area that has to be addressed if they're going to turn this around. Because if you can't get the homeowners, if you can't get the consumers' income to grow, there's no chance of having an economic recovery. The United States, over 70% of the economy is directly dependent upon the consumer. I'm talking consumption and residential housing. You don't have growth in the inflation-adjusted income, you can't have growth in the inflation-adjusted consumption, and that's what drives the GDP. Now, that's basic. Income drives consumption. You can borrow some growth from the future by increasing debt, expanding debt. And we went through a decade or two of that where, again, the average consumer couldn't make ends meet, but his or her debt use expanded sharply. We had a debt collapse back in the panic of 2008. We're still living through that. The average guy can't get the type of credit he had beforehand. So that feature, which had enabled people to buy beyond their means to make up the shortfall on their living standards, is largely not there. So until the consumer liquidity is addressed, there's not going to be an economic recovery here.
But I'd like to also discuss the precious metal situation. In retrospect, I think we can see now that the threat of Fed tapering combined with that of higher interest rates rattled the markets a bit. And, of course, the market had become quite frothy, and we are aware of the fact that rates had to inch higher. Of course, if we take a look at Gibson's paradox, we recognize that negative interest rates are ultimately a very important driver for higher precious metals. Do you see rates as posing a threat on a forward basis to the precious metals, or has that threat passed?
Well, I generally agree with your assessment there, although I think what we've seen to precious metals in the happen to them in the last year has been very much orchestrated, and there's been some direct intervention. All this nonsense back and forth between the different Fed people, oh, the Fed's going to taper, it's not going to taper, was used very openly to try and manipulate gold in conjunction with somebody, and I think the somebody was associated with the U.S. government or the Federal Reserve. They're the people that it helps the most, and central banks and governments generally don't like strong gold prices because it's a vote of confidence in terms of how well they're handling things, and these guys have not been handling things well at all. The tapering, let me discuss the tapering a minute, because there are a couple of major factors here that are going to play it on the near term. You could have volatility with it, but long term, gold prices are going to rally strongly. And I'm not into day-to-day gold trading, nor am I advocating that. But I do look at gold as a hedge against the tremendous loss of purchasing power in the dollar that lies ahead. And as such, if you hold it as that hedge and through the rough time, whether you get it at $1,000, $2,000, or $20,000 before it hits $100,000 and $1,000,000, doesn't make too much difference. It'll preserve your purchasing power when the dollar crisis hits. Let's look at the Fed a minute, because that's as the global markets look at it, the Fed's quantitative easing is a direct effort. And in fact, if you look at Bernanke's description of what he was planning here back in 2002, it's basically an effort to debase the U.S. dollar. Back in 2008, we had a panic, we had a crisis. The threat was that the U.S. banking system and the financial system would collapse. They weren't kidding about that. Things had been terribly misplayed in Washington and by the Fed. But to have the system fail was not an option for them. So what happened was you saw extraordinary intervention. The Fed created whatever money it had to. They lent whatever they had to do. They guaranteed whatever they had to do. They intervened wherever they had to. They bailed out whatever companies they had to do. They bought large institutions that could threaten the system if they failed, and they were failing. They did everything in their power, and it's both the government and the Federal Reserve, to prevent a systemic collapse. And they stabilized the system. They actually prevented the collapse. But in doing so, the extraordinary measures that they took did nothing to resolve the basic imbalances. They didn't resolve the system. It pushed the problems into the future. We're in that future. We're about to see these problems unwind again, and they're still unwinding. And we're going to have a very difficult year ahead of us. If you look at the Fed's quantitative easing, that was never designed to stimulate the economy. That's all a mind game, the Fed with the markets and the public. If you listen to Bernanke, he stated very clearly that there is nothing that the Fed can do right now to stimulate the economy. So when he talks about, we'll use as a guideline that unemployment drops to such and such a rate, it's not because he thinks that the Fed's going to be able to bring the rate down. It is he's using the economy as political cover for the quantitative easing. The purpose of the quantitative easing is to provide liquidity and stability to the banking system. That's the Fed's primary function in life. This is a central bank. It's a private corporation. It's not controlled or owned by the government. It's controlled and owned by the banking system. It has some federal controls on it and indeed a mandate to promote economic activity and contain inflation. But all that is that's all subservient to keeping the banking system afloat. So that this quantitative easing is, in terms of how it's presented, is largely a fraud. If the banking system were healthy, if banks were lending normally, we'd be at least seeing the option of being able to expand the economy through debt expansion. Banks are not lending normally. They're still in trouble. We're seeing that the all the money the Fed has pumped into the system, the banks have lent back to the Fed as excess bank reserves. It hasn't gone into normal lending, which would have increased the money supply and would have helped the economy. Banking system's in trouble. The Fed has no options here. It's backed itself into a corner of continuing to provide liquidity. And as a result, this minimal tapering that we saw a couple of weeks ago, I view that as basically a little bit of window dressing to help the new Fed chairman as she comes into power, and maybe to take a little criticism out of the markets. But the Fed is, the way they've set it up, and assuming they're not looking to have a systemic collapse, they're tied into continuing to provide liquidity. You're not going to have much more in the way of tapering. They're either going to pull back on it or actually expand it because of ongoing and deepening problems in the system. They're going to continue to use a weakening economy as political cover. As this happens, that will provide tremendous selling pressure against the dollar, and it should in turn tend to rally gold. The other big factor which gets heavily jawboned and manipulated is the budget deficit circumstance. If you go back to the middle of 2011, we had a crisis there that almost started to trigger a dollar panic. And again, you had massive intervention to turn things around. I'll call it a secondary panic to 2008. That was a time when you had the Standard & Poor's downgraded the credit rating of the United States. They couldn't let the system collapse. They wanted to maintain, although they're trying to debase the dollar, they don't want to see a dollar panic. They don't want to see gold soar, again, because that shows a lack of confidence, includes and increases the lack of confidence in the system. So there were direct interventions. Switzerland tied the Swiss franc to the euro. All sorts of things happened at that time. And the politicians in Washington pushed off the deficit negotiations till after the 2012 election. And what did they do? They just pushed it off till after the 2014 election. Now, I know they have an agreement on 2014 and 2015, but they did nothing in the process to address the long-term solvency issues of the United States. That's what the global markets are expecting. That's what they're looking for. That's not happening. That's going to come to a head again in this next month. Any bad news there will tend to create dollar selling pressure, and again, should be beneficial to gold. There are other areas that will offer some surprises to the currency and gold markets. One is economy. The official story again is economy is recovering. I'm contending the economy is sinking anew. And you look at what happened on Friday. There was a shock to the system with the relatively low level of jobs gain that was reported from the payroll employment. That number was weaker than expected. What you have to consider here is that these numbers are not extraordinarily meaningful, and you have a confidence interval around the reporting. And based on the regular plus or minus here, which is 129,000 jobs with a 95% confidence interval, that report on Friday could have been a contraction as easily as a gain. What did you see? You saw some dollar selling. You saw some rally in gold. That effect is there. The economy comes in weaker than expected. It usually is a negative for the economy that's weak. Fourth thing that's not being looked at too carefully, although increasingly it'll take a blame for what will become weakness in the dollar, and that is a political confidence or the political stability of a given country relative to the rest of the world. I'm not saying that our political system is unstable, but I can tell you, as someone who's followed the currency markets for a long time, that a good surrogate for how the government's being viewed, and it does affect the dollar, is the approval rating of the president. Right now we're at a low. I mean, you saw similar circumstances with Nixon. The markets are telling you what they think. So you put those four factors together, you have an environment here that suggests a very difficult time for the dollar, which will be inflationary because as the dollar falls, it tends to spike oil prices, spikes gasoline prices. It's not the coming into inflation. There are two types of inflation here, sort of like two types of falls in unemployment. One's a relatively happy circumstance. The other one is not. When you see stronger inflation, and this is the way Wall Street usually views it, and people say, oh, we need some inflation to make the economy grow. That doesn't happen. What happens is if you have a strong economy, strong demand, demand's outstripping supply, that creates inflation. Prices are rising in an environment of a strong economy, strong demand, and that's a relatively happy inflation because people are getting in. Getting employed, people can live with that. They adjust their thinking accordingly in how they handle their funds. The type of inflation you don't want to see is the one that we have had recently on and off, and that's been due to the Fed's efforts at debasing the dollar. When they've debased the dollar and been able to knock the dollar down, you see an upturn in oil prices and gasoline prices. That's not being driven by strong gasoline demand. It's being driven by weakness in the dollar and bad monetary policy. And in a weak economy where you don't have the strong demand, what happens in something like high gasoline prices, people have limited income, and if gasoline's a necessity for them in terms of getting to work or such, then they have to make a decision and cut back in consuming in other areas. It actually becomes an economic detriment. That's the type of inflation that's going to be coming this year as the dollar weakens. But that, nonetheless, that should be a positive factor for gold prices.
I wanted to address this apparent equities melt-up that we've seen, particularly in the last 12 months. It seems to have its roots in the 2009 credit crisis. Emerging from that, we've seen essentially ever-rising stock prices. Some folks have pointed to better than expected corporate earnings. Others have noted the alarming rise in capital purchases, i.e. where companies essentially repurchase their own shares, decreasing supply and increasing demand somewhat. As we've seen the Dow Jones Industrials post sometimes 6, 7, 8 all-time record highs, at least nominal highs, really an unusual event. We haven't seen anything quite like it since the year 2000, and we all know how that ended. I'd like your take.
I'm not a big fan of the stock market at the moment. I think what you've seen since the crisis, again, has been largely orchestrated by the Fed where they could. The thing is, anyone who owns a company that's traded on in the open markets will generally take actions to make their stock price higher. That's generally what executives at publicly held companies tend to do. That usually means you want to, you take things to strengthen your company. But if you can use accounting gimmicks or whatever, that certainly has gotten used quite heavily. I don't see the fundamentals here as being good at all. The economy remains in the doldrums. Most of the gains you've seen in earnings have been due to accounting gimmicks, one-time write-offs. The list is almost endless, but it's not solid fundamental progress. You're not seeing people, corporations generally with booming sales and earnings booming from that. It's usually from some side issue. The Fed continues to try and seems at least they're trying to target the stock market to make it rally. They don't have any options in terms of stimulating the economy, at least as they admit, or at least they traditionally do. There's been some talk, and I can believe it, that Mr. Bernanke would like to see stock prices higher. I think most people would like to see stock prices higher. But he's figuring that if he can get stocks to rally, that'll create a wealth effect, and that would counter lack of income growth, and people can spend more money, and that'll stimulate the economy. I generally, I view the market as rigged and out of touch with reality, and I would say it's very likely to have a very unhappy end. That's the last place, personally, I'd put my money here. I have a lot of friends, love the guys on Wall Street, but this is just not a time for stocks. It's time for battening down the hatches and riding out what I think is going to be a very difficult financial storm, which means trying to preserve your wealth in what's likely going to be a very inflationary time. Your best hedge on that is to own some physical gold, silver, and with the basics in place there, getting some of your assets outside the United States, at least outside the U.S. dollar.
Well, I'd also like your take then as we approach the 100, I guess we're on the cusp here of the 100th anniversary for the Federal Reserve, which began in December 23rd, 1913. So we've seen roughly 18 recessions. The U.S. dollar has declined by nearly 98% over its tenure. The U.S. national debt has increased by a factor of 5,000-fold. I'd like to know just what you see as the future for the Federal Reserve.
Well, I have no particular insights as to where the Fed is heading here, but I can tell you that in terms of the system, we're likely going to see enough of a disruption to the system and the crises ahead that it wouldn't surprise me at all to see a change in how the central bank the United States was structured. The country does need some form of central bank that handles the currency and monetary policy. It doesn't have to be the Fed. There are all sorts of options. The Fed is certainly going to do everything it can to maintain its control and power, and so the large banks. The banks love the Fed. The Fed does what it can to keep the banks going. And you need a healthy banking system. What can I tell you? If your banking system collapses, you're not going to have normal commerce, and you're going to have very difficult times. People may not like big banks, but something like that has to be in play for commerce to work. So I think you're going to see significant restructuring of the system. I think eventually you're going to see the dollar become worthless. That could even happen in the next year with a hyperinflation. That happens. What will have to happen is that you're going to have a new currency system structure, both likely for the United States and globally. I mean, you're talking the world's reserve currency with the U.S. dollar. Some people advocate, let's put the dollar on the gold standard. I have no problems with that concept. The gold standard imposes certain disciplines on the system, and there's those disciplines that Franklin Roosevelt wanted to get around, which is why he abandoned the domestic gold system back in the 30s. But we don't have we can't abandon the current system and go to something that's easier to live with or more expansive. We've gone as far as you can in terms of you know, the expansive, not backed by anything type currency. The problem there is that it wouldn't work. No new currency system would work until the federal government circumstance is put into balance. If it's fiscally balanced, you can then have a stable currency. If it's as fiscally imbalanced as it is today, and you had a gold standard, the government would be devaluing the currency against gold on a regular basis, because it still had the same problems that it has today. So the, for any solution to work here, there has to be some addressing of the basic underlying fundamentals. From the standpoint of the country's finances, it's a fiscal circumstance. From some standpoint of the economy, you've got to do something to bring the trade circumstance back into balance and to recreate the type of U.S. production that we had before. That type of a basis, you can have a healthy economy, the government and operating in balance, and you can have very good times and positive growth going forward. But it's very difficult to get there. I don't think the Federal Reserve is going to be a surviving entity in that. I would expect as things get reorganized, some other system will be put into place, because the Fed's going to be viewed as part of a failed system, much as a fiat currency will be viewed as part of a failed system here too.
I also wanted to ask you about this theme of hyperinflation. I mean, you have quite a treatise there posted online, a dissertation on hyperinflation, which you regularly update.
There's one online that's open to the public, and the points in it are basically the same. We're coming into the time frame in which I look for the hyperinflation. I think we'll see it by the end of the year. It's the type of thing that would have happened at the end of the decade had we had not the crisis in 2008, but all that was done in 2008 accelerated the process, which is why I think we're going to see it this year. I think it'll be triggered by a massive decline in the dollar, and we did discuss some of the areas where the dollar's likely to have some trouble in the near future.
You know, the greenback, interesting technical situation where it's had every opportunity for at least 3 years to stage a rally, especially with all the trouble in the Eurozone, to take off like a rocket ship. And every single time, it's knocked back down into this broad trading range. So, yes, I'd certainly like your thoughts on hyperinflation, but I'd also hope that you could factor in to the discussion some of the more salient points that I think the deflationists, this alarming trend in derivatives, and more importantly, the interest rate-sensitive derivatives. Apparently, there is between $250 trillion and $300 trillion on our five largest money center banks on their balance sheet.
If you go back to 2008, and we go back and look at Bernanke's comments in 2002 and Janet Yellen, purportedly is pretty much in Bernanke's camp, there's talk of the risk of a major deflation, 1930s-style deflation. In order for that to happen, you need a collapse in the money supply. That did happen in the 30s. Basically, you had failures in the banking system, and as the banks went out of business, people who had their money on deposits with the banks lost their money. You didn't have anything at that in those days, such as deposit insurance. That was after the fact. So, as the banks failed, the money supply contracted. The cash that had been in the banks, those deposits which were part of the money supply, were gone. So the money supply collapsed about a third, inflation was down about a third, and the economy was down about a third. And those were related to each other. Coming into the 2008 crisis, there was fear of a run on the banks and maybe a 1930s-style repeat in terms of deflation. Everything was done possible to prevent it, including guaranteeing all the deposits, anyone's exposure. There's not going to be any disappearance of the money supply. Derivatives, I mean, there's always dangers there that you have somebody on the other side of a derivative contract who is not going to be able to honor their obligation, and, you know, someone takes a major loss, and that triggers all sorts of problems, particularly if you have a circumstance where banks are too big to fail policy. My reading on it is that the Fed, again, will do whatever it has to do to prevent a collapse of the banking system, an implosion in the money supply. It can create whatever money it wants. You're seeing it. I mean, you go to when TARP was being negotiated, so it's $800 billion, a lot of talk back and forth, and they finally passed it. And then Bernanke, the next Monday morning, separately created $800 billion out of thin air for his use. He can create or Janet Yellen, going forward, could create any amount of money that they want. The derivatives, the size of the derivative contracts is not the exposure there theoretically is a small portion of that. It's against the change in the total value of the contract, not the total of the value, the total value in the contract. Something shy of $250 billion, it's still an extraordinary amount in terms of what's occurred by those policies. But the Fed has the ability to create that money. I would think that that by itself might actually act as a hyperinflation trigger to have the Fed in there bailing out the system. I don't think they're going to let the system sink into a depressionary collapse. One argument that I've heard about arguing in favor of the deflation is that, well, we've had a credit collapse, and there are still credit defaults that can blow the system apart here. Generally, as long as you've got the Fed supporting the banking system, the banks don't fail and people don't lose deposits on hand, money supply's not going to crash. If I'm a lender and you're my business customer, I lend you $1 million. You deposit that $1 million with me or another bank, and the way the system used to work when banks were lending money normally, that would expand into $10 million of money supply, because wherever you deposited your funds, that bank would lend 90% of it out to someone else and so on down the road. Now, the guy that borrowed the million that created $10 million of money supply. Let's say he goes out of business and he defaults on his loan. He can't pay it off. I'm the bank. I can't recover that loan. Not only can I not recover that loan, I can't pull out of the money supply system the other $9 million that was created. So the default there by itself does not contract the money supply. What happens is that as the bank, I take a loss, hits my balance sheet, I can't lend as much money. And we still don't have a healthy banking system. I mean, maybe the nationalizing the banks, I don't know. There are all sorts of things that can be done to reset the system. But as long as they don't let the banks fail and they stand behind the banks, there's no immediate collapse in the money supply. What happens is the money supply growth slows because the banks are not lending the money in a normal fashion. That we do have, and that is an ongoing problem, and it's an ongoing symptom of problems in the banking system. Nonetheless, as you look at the money supply, it's still up a little over 3% year to year, broad measure, and it is it's slowing. It's the growth is positive, but you also have, let's say, the M3, as I measured, is up around $15 trillion. You have at least that amount overhanging the U.S. market outside the United States in the form of cash. Your cash instruments that could be liquidated and repatriated overnight if the markets wanted to. That's the type of thing that would happen in a currency crisis. And that would throw a tremendous amount of new cash into the system. Fed would have to respond or see the financial system collapse. I mean, talk about interest rates going higher. foreign investors dump the bonds they're holding, that would you'd see an immediate response in the bond market. The Fed would step in to buy the bonds. But as the dollar sells off, you're also going to be finding a very severe cost push coming from higher commodity prices such as oil. You combine those factors and the loss of the global confidence in the dollar and what I think will be a coincident collapse in the domestic confidence in the dollar, the circumstance where you're likely going to see the dollar lose its reserve currency status, you end up with a very, very bad inflationary situation that rapidly can evolve into that hyperinflation that I'm talking about.
We see virtually every sector of society, except maybe the top 0.1%, struggling to make ends meet. Roughly 50 million Americans on food stamps, plus we have roughly half of Americans receiving some type of government assistance.
Well, again, this is an environment where, at least in its breaking, will be cost push. That's not a standard way of. Not a standard way that most people look at inflation, but it happens most of the time. I mean, the last couple of recessions generally have been inflationary recessions. Problem is that you have, as the inflation starts to pick up people can't respond to it, the economy takes a greater hit. It's the type of thing that the dollar, where the dollar quickly loses its purchasing power. You'll see people generally fleeing for other assets or a barter system, something like that. As they begin to abandon the currency, the currency becomes literally worthless. The foreign investors have enough dollars to push us in that into that mode.
I wonder if you might tell folks a bit more about what they can expect at ShadowStats, as well as your latest reports and commentary.
Well, we're always welcome visitors to our site. There are a number of areas, or a number of commentaries that are available to the public, such as the Hyperinflation 2012, which gives you the basic story on hyperinflation. The report that's just been published is on a subscription-only basis. We're always happy to get new subscribers, but you can get the general gist of it if you want by just looking at what's been written before there. We do discuss the quality issues with the different numbers, how they've gone astray, where they actually are. There's public comment on inflation that explains how inflation, as we see it from Uncle Sam, is understated, which has all sorts of negative impacts for people looking for income adjustment or investment returns. So it's shadowstats.com. Upper right-hand column will give you the open missives, and the left-hand column shows you what's been published recently, the headlines there, which are available. Thanks, Chris.
Well, the precious metal stocks have been showing signs of life. Maybe the bottom could be in place. Joining me with the answer, with his unique technical and fundamental vantage points on the markets, Mr. Bob Hoy, editor and chief investment strategist at institutionaladvisors.com. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Chris, good to be with you, especially at these fascinating markets we have.
You know, isn't it interesting? I was thumbing through some of the documentary programs that are offered as part of Amazon Prime, which is essentially just a nice little feature you can sign up for. I would say I came across five or six different programs last night, some of them on the universe, some on solar systems, four programs, that was it. That was the season. They don't have enough material. Even Stephen Hawking's, I believe, has two programs. Each series is comprised of only two shows. And yes, it's packed with fascinating information. The markets, however, provide us an endless stream of information, don't they?
Isn't it? It's continuous. And And when you get hooked on it, it becomes a way of life. And I've been hooked on it for a long time. But what you want to determine is when there's a bunch of newbies in the market. Here, our basic theme is that once you're in the post-bubble contraction, the 2007 blowout we're considering as the equivalent of 1929, or the previous one in 1873, then the tendency is that the orthodox side of the equation, stocks, corporate bonds, do very well, and at the going opposite, the precious metal sector does not good or poorly, or as we've seen in the last year, dreadful. So here we are. And then the stock market and the credit markets, I think, will be the guide to this. And you had the dot-com bubble in 2000. Crash ended in 2002. Then you had the big bull market that then brought in real estate, and it brought in commodity speculation, so it was that made it a classic. And it blew out in 2007. But that, to the high in October 2007, from the bottom, the end of the crash, was 249 weeks. So then we look at, then you had the crash down to 2009. You had the very vigorous, financial markets. Poor economy, but the financial markets where the action is. And to right at the first of the year, December 31st highs, that was 252 weeks compared to 2007, which is 249 weeks. But then if we go back to the crash in 1929 that completed in 1932, and then you had the top of the very vigorous stock market to 1937, and Chris, that ran for 249 weeks. It got up to an RSI of 74. And the RSI in 2007, it only got to a little over 70. But in looking back on it, I think that at that time, the subprime mortgage market was coming apart, and credit spreads had started to widen in that June. So that was tempering the speculation, and it drove stocks up to the high, the cyclical high in October. So, and here we are. You've got 62% bulls on investors' intelligence. You've got the RSI right up there at 75 or 76. Now, there is another couple of little tricks in here, and in October, when you're in a very good stock market, sometimes October can have a pretty good hit. And in October the 9th, our technical indicators signaled on the S&P what we call a springboard pattern, and it's a springboard buy. And that suggested that whatever bad was going to happen in October had happened, and then that then springboard buy has been the conditioner on the month. And now you're up here with tremendous signs of measurable signs of speculation. And then the other thing that we did is, so when this thing really started going well in November, we said, well, where are your typical seasonal highs? And one would be the Thanksgiving weekend, had a good high there and then backed off. And then you had the other probable high would be right at the turn of the year, which can extend into January. Big highs at the turn of the year, of course, was the big speculation in silver and gold in January 1980. You had the high for the Tokyo speculation on the Nikkei right at the end of 1989. And then there was another one back there, 1973 stock market. It had its high right at the end of the year. So everything combined on the stock market suggests we're at a cyclical peak. So then if you go over and look into the credit markets, they have been party time because the whole world has been buying lower grade corporate bonds and municipals and emerging market debt. And this sector has been acting very well on the charts. And until a few weeks ago when the action began to slow down a bit, so you're starting to get a widening of credit spreads. And a couple of days ago, under some stock market pressure, all of these things, whether it was junk bonds or high yield or munis or emerging market debt bonds, they took out the 50-day moving average, which has provided support for over the last year. So we're watching that one, and that is providing a negative divergence. And so the stock market and the bond market are at what we consider cyclical peaks. Now, let's go over to the precious metal side, where you have you've had a lot of gloom. We had momentum, record momentum declines, a year ago in April, May. And then now, if you use a longer momentum thing like the monthly RSI, it's down there on whether you look at the gold or the GDX, the stocks. They're at monthly RSI lows, very low. And then if you use the same monthly RSIs on, say, the S&P, it's very high. So this, you've got very measures, technical measures of sentiment and momentum, negative for gold and very positive for the stocks and the bonds. So how long they can keep this pot boiling? I don't know, maybe a few weeks. There's another assistance possible for the gold side, and that is that the base metals sector, and back in 2011, we have a proprietary model, we call it the momentum peak forecaster, so when this thing kicks in, doesn't very often, and it goes straight up, it then signals that the speculation is right out of hand. And whatever they're speculating in will probably complete within a month or so. And that was the case in 2011. And the speculative items were silver and gold plus the base metals. So they've all been in a big bear market since. But a few weeks ago, the base metals became quite oversold. And we figure that they're recovering, and they have done. There's been a satisfying rally so far, and you've also had a pretty good rally out of the base metals there. So we thought that when this turn came in, it would be a pretty big rotation out of, say, the high-flying stocks like Tesla or Netflix or the financials, which are still flying, and into the old basic base metals. So, and this is starting to work. And I'm not sure how long the base metals can go up, but it's helping the precious metal side. And the other thing about 6-7 weeks ago, what we call them the silver dogs, Silver Standard and Pan American Silver, they had become oversold, and they were starting to creep base and then creep up a little when a lot of other junior stocks and gold stocks were, and now they're silver, we're having trouble. And actually, we put a piece out on it called The Silver Dogs, that their stability and firming was quite impressive and could be leading perhaps to better things. And so far, we're staying with that.
What are your numbers showing with regard to an ultimate bottom on precious metals?
Oh, I think we're there because this is the ultimate top in the stock market. And sure, we've had some good rallies over the last year, but these were on the way down. And no, and this, to me, this is it. The key thing was the 250-month bull market for stocks, corporate bonds, and for, well, you can't call it a bull market for the economy, but the economy's been recovering for the same length of time, and that was the best it could do in 1937. So the question is, say if I were a policymaker and had sat down with you and I and we'd reviewed these successes in the stock and bond markets with the policymaker, well, the policymaker is going to say, yes, as you point out, it's overbought, but can't this overbought condition be eased by a whole lot of sideways action, you know, drift down a bit and then go sideways? And my answer would be, I think not, because these numbers we're getting now in sentiment and momentum are the same as in 2007, 2000 in the tech bubble, and in 1937 on the rebound out of the 1929 crash. So I don't see an easy way out of these current market excesses.
There's a tendency, as the Wall Street adage says, for these markets to remain more frothy than we can remain solvent.
Oh, yeah. That's I think it was Carrie Schilling that came out with that one. But you have virtually the identical numbers at previous big highs. So I think the wonder is how long it can go is how many. It's only a matter of weeks.
We've also seen an interesting trend, change of the guard at the Federal Reserve. We've often seen capitulation on the upside, almost a melt-up in the markets, followed by serious downside. And here's an example of Volcker and Greenspan. You know, I think we're going back to the 1987 time frame. And then we fast forward to Greenspan and Bernanke, and I want to say that was the year 2006, not too long before we saw the zenith in the markets. And then once again, here we are with Bernanke and, of course, Dr. Janet Yellen. Will history repeat?
I think I'm glad you mentioned Volcker, because that one is instructive. He had been worked at the Fed as a younger man, then came in as the chairman. And that was in one of the greatest speculations in gold and silver in history. And also, it was a huge speculation in commodities, in basic materials, huge inflation in wages. And that's what the whole package is what drove inflation up to 14%, and the yield on the long bond got up to 15%. Now, then my contention on that blowout, and this one also, although we developed the momentum peak forecaster after 1980, but that one did register the highest since we've been running this thing. We backtracked it to the early 60s. So that was a blowout in commodities and in wages and inflation. And if you take a look at the money supply figures annually for 1979, 1980, 81, 82, no decline there. So Volcker got in, and a speculation collapsed, and then the street gave him credit for doing something that ended inflation. And it has been a lot of nonsense, because at that time, the historical work I had done pointed out that when you've had an era of huge soaring price inflation, and it blows out and ends, then you start an era of financial asset inflation. So in 1981, 82, when I was making presentations, it was that I said, this is going to be a different thing, that no matter how much the Fed prints, stocks and bonds would outperform commodities. Well, the fund managers at that time couldn't believe it. This was incomprehensible. So the point I want to make is that Volcker kept the pedal to the metal. Money supply figures did not shrink at all. Commodities crashed, and that then set up the inflation in financial assets. So here we are. We've got fabulous, and this is where, if you go back to September 2012, when Bernanke announced the great bond buying program, Well, all the gold bugs went crazy and said, this is it. This is the inflation that's going to drive gold to the moon and the dollar in the opposite direction. Well, if you're looking back on it now, one should have gone and bought bonds because the Fed was buying bonds. And I'll take one more step that's a bit tricky, and that is that it's not so much that what you ended up with is inflation in bond prices, and unless there were speculators in bonds, the Fed easing stimulus, QE, wouldn't have worked so well. So here's where the gold bugs miss it, is that in their mind, inflation is only soaring asset prices, and of course with gold being the best one, or silver. And they don't quite grasp that soaring asset prices for stocks and bonds is inflation of a different form. So my contention here is that when this stock and bond market rolls over, and that has been accommodating the Fed's urge to ease credit, it'll shut the window on them. So it's not so much who will be the chairman, and it's well understood that Yellen will keep the foot pedal to the metal, but it doesn't matter. The markets will decide what will be the next speculative group, and you determine that by noting which is the speculative group now, stocks and bonds, at the limit, and which is the non-speculative sector, well, the metal prices, base metals and precious metals. So this is going to be another thing like 1980, where it was a huge change, and it probably, I would love to debate with any central banker that Volcker did something that changed the game in 1980, because what it was is history changed the game. So Janet Yellen will be there. She will try to inflate and persuade everybody that she can get in the economy going and all that sort of stuff. But when you're in a post-bubble contraction, the recessions are severe. 2008 was severe. And the recovery since 2009 has been very weak. And that's typical of a post-bubble condition. So, and all of the action's gone into stocks and bonds. And now it's the turn for the action in gold and silver.
It sounds as though you would say that silver and gold are fairly valued. They're near their intrinsic value in terms of their individual fundamental metrics. However, when the bubbles du jour, i.e. stocks and bonds, finally do roll over, the huge amount of speculative, frothy money pouring from pension funds, mutual funds, will start to look for the tiny gold and silver market.
Yeah, and we've done the work back to 1700, and the first great bubble completed in 1720, the infamous South Sea Bubble. And there's been 2007 was the sixth great bubble, and all five previous ones were followed by lengthy periods of credit contraction. And it's best to call them, if you want to call them, a great depression, but a great contraction. And in those conditions, whereby you have pricing pressure from weak commodity prices, and that filters through the whole economy so that it gets very competitive, and most business and commerce can't raise their prices and find it tough. Those weak prices for wages, labor, mining, power, and everything else, that becomes very weak when the price of gold is firming up. So this is where in each post-bubble contraction, the gold sector has been the sector that does very well and consistently. So, but then the only intrusion upon the bliss of a good gold market in the post-bubble contraction is when you have a normal business recovery, which we've had since 2009. And the gold sector has not done well. And then as this business recovery rolls over and the stocks and bonds roll over, then the action will shift over to gold. And we can be back to party time again. I know it'll be a whole lot more fun with Bun's got some interest in some junior mining companies and you're getting good results and you have a market that appreciates those results. It'll happen. I don't know how soon, But I think that the turning point for orthodox investments in stocks and bonds for the high is very close. And then as soon as that seriously rolls over, that'll release a new bull market for gold and silver. But from time to time, because if we go into a liquidity crisis, well, then gold stocks are going to get hit. But you can still have gold and silver doing rather well. So you can mark me down as positive for the precious metal side.
Many of the great contrarians like John Templeton and so many others have taught us that we need to go hunting for investments that are in unloved, unfavored sectors. And the level of bearishness, I think you would agree, in the precious metals equities sector has reached incredibly negative levels.
Well, being here in Vancouver, you hear some of the stories where some really good straight-up geological guys with a good mining story and have had, you know, up until 2011, you had a decade of good times, and these guys have not only had to sell their cottage up in the country or at Whistler Mountain, but they've also had to sell the big house in Vancouver. So it is as wicked and bad as it ever gets.
So we're going to take that, though, as a positive. Look forward in 2014 to see some rotation out of the more bubbly sectors and perhaps take some profits on some Tesla.
Yeah, I can wrap it up in just a couple of phrases. And in 2011, we used the silver-gold ratio as a guide because in a bull market for precious metals, silver will always outperform gold. So the RSI on the silver-gold ratio in 2011 got up to 92. I mean, that is really high. Like anything around 80, we consider dangerous. And the last time, and the only other time you had that RSI up to 92 was in January of 1980. So when it hit there in 2011, we thought, well, this is, it's not going to be, it'll be unpleasant, but it won't be as bad as what followed 1980. And, hey, well, that was modest. So now we're getting opposite conditions to 2011 and also to 1980. So, but it ain't going to be easy. But say a year from now, I think it'll be party time in the gold and silvers.
But if we look at that 1980s peak in silver and gold, and we adjust forward by a factor of about 2.7 using the inflation deflator, you know, it really does suggest that the 50s peak in 2011 on silver and, let's say, 1920s on gold was premature for calling an ultimate peak. I know it feels on a nominal basis, you know, that was the end. It was 1980s all over again.
The thing is, for it's the dynamics. It's dynamic and sentiment. Value is something else for other people to figure out. But you had, in 2011, you had the momentum and you had sentiment, and now you got momentum and sentiment that the opposite. So this is where we feel, and you can't call her for next week, but this is definitely the start, close to the start of a new bull, a cyclical bull market for precious metals.
And where do you stand on the possibility that we might have one final leg down to retest that 1,000 gold and maybe 15, 16 silver?
Again, it comes down to that: how do the stocks and bond markets get out of an exceptionally overbought condition? Not by going sideways. So, yeah, as a technician and as a trader, there's always a possibility of another downtick, but you know, the markets, take a look at your silver dogs, silver standard. There's been a number of tests since the low 5-6 weeks ago, so the market is being tested to the actual price of gold. The key now, Chris, is the overbought on the orthodox side and the oversold on the gold side, and one should have your favorite little stocks and accumulate them on bad days, and probably within a month this will be the rotation will have become visible.
I wonder if you could please tell us more about institutional advisors. What folks can expect from your service, please?
We've been in flogging research to institutions since the early 80s, and we cover, obviously, interest rates and the credit markets, equities, currencies, commodities, and gold and silver. And the historical work we've done has been a very good guide. And then as to bubbles and post-bubble conditions. And then my colleague on the technical work is some of the best you can get anywhere. So where we look at is when we were looking for a possible high for the stock market around the turn of the year, say January. Then when you get there, you look and say, is it overbought? Yeah, it's screamingly overbought. So this is how it works, and you can get us at the website institutionaladvisors.com, or one can just Google my name, Bob Hoy, and it gets everything comes up. There's a lot of work we've been published, and we don't send out back issues for inspection, but we just people are interested, we just put you on the service for 4 or 5 weeks and say if you like it, you're on. If you don't want it, that's fine. No, very easy, no problems.
Well, Bob Hoy, we appreciate your thoughts today, and we wish you continued success in 2014.
Very good, Chris. Anytime.